Macbeth, the fun of Oklahoma, and more satisfaction than a turkey dinner. All this and more at the Amalga Chamber Orchestra Concert, November 17 and 18 at Northern Light Church. Flautist Sally Schlichting and soprano Kathleen Wayne are the featured soloists. The music of Mozart, Griffiths, Stitt, and Schubert's beloved Unfinished Symphony will be conducted by William Todd Hunt. Tickets and information for the Amalga Chamber Orchestra at operatogo.net. $15 general, $13 senior, and $5 student tickets.
And we'll be talking to Todd Hunt, you just heard right there, in just a moment. Opera to go with the Amalga Chamber Orchestra here on Juno Afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Andy Klein. Also be talking to folks putting on the Survivors of Suicide Day event. This is the National Adoption Month, and there's going to be a fundraiser. We'll be talking to folks there about that. Arthur Karsten Heuer will be in here talking to us about being caribou. He spent 5 months on foot with an Arctic caribou herd with his wife, and relays that in a short film tonight, and also a Evening at Egan lecture happening on Friday. Also, Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. Rain showers in the forecast with highs around 41 degrees. Rain is likely for tonight, and rain with snow likely in the morning for Friday, rain in the afternoon, and snow accumulation predicted to be about 1 inch for tomorrow, but then rain in the afternoon, so probably go away into that slushy mess that we know so well here in Juneau. And rain and snow likely Friday night. Mostly cloudy skies for the weekend with a slight chance of snow, and cloudy and colder for Saturday night and Sunday with mostly cloudy skies. Coming up next, it's National Native News. We'll be right back here with Todd Hunt.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Autone, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. First Nations people across Canada are mourning the loss of a legend in the Aboriginal community. Jim Sinclair was a founding member of the Native Council of Canada and the Métis National Council. His funeral is today, Dan Karpinchuk reports.
Jim Sinclair served as the president of the Association of Métis and Non-Status Indians of Saskatchewan from 1970 to 1988. During that time, he helped found the Dumont Technical Institute and the Gabriel Dumont Institute. But it was in 1982 that he achieved national prominence by taking the federal government to court in a bid to have Métis people recognized in the Canadian Constitution. His legal challenge was settled out of court. He also met with Pope John Paul II on several occasions to talk about Aboriginal issues. Roger Ross was a longtime family friend of St. Clair's.
He was a leader like none we've ever seen before, and chances are we'll never see another one like him. His role on the international scene, you know, having audiences with the Pope, talking to the Queen and negotiating treaty rights and just rights overall, human rights for First Nations and Métis people, that is unparalleled in our time.
In 2006, Sinclair won a Lifetime Achievement Honor from the National Aboriginal Achievement Awards. Just before his death, he was president of the Congress of Aboriginal Peoples of Saskatchewan. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
A three-day Native Language Summit is underway in western South Dakota. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports, tribal leaders and educators from across the U.S. are working to preserve their distinct languages.
The annual Lakota, Dakota, Nakota Language Summit is taking place in Rapid City, South Dakota. Leaders have the goal of preserving native languages for North American tribes. Leaders from South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota, Nebraska, Montana, and Canada are attending the various seminars and workshops to take ideas back to their tribes. Officials from other tribes are participating as well, as all participants share techniques and best practices for improving language fluency. The summit's organizer, Mike Carlo, says this year's event features discussions on language immersion schools and strategic plans for long-term revitalization. Carlo says the biggest obstacle to fluency is a lack of exposure to individual native languages. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
According to voting advocates and organizers in North Dakota, there's still no definitive numbers of how many Native Americans went to the polls last week. But at the moment, it's estimated that around 4,000 Native voters cast ballots during the election, and much of that voter turnout resulted from heavy on-the-ground mobilization from voter advocacy groups. The North Dakota Nonpartisan League says, along with heavy engagement with Native voters, many candidates took the time to visit North Dakota's Native communities to deliver stump speeches and ask for votes. One candidate in particular, now Senator Democrat Heidi Heitkamp, worked extensively to court Native voters, and North Dakota Nonpartisan League Executive Director Prairie Rose Seminole says Heitkamp's win by just under 3,000 votes could have something to do with a well-organized and mobilized Native vote. As well, with a solid win that could be credited to Indian Country, Seminole says she looks forward to what Heitkamp will do for Indian Country.
She said she would work for getting the Native provisions in the Violence Against Women Act pushed through. She would sit on the Indian Affairs Committee. She would work with our tribal governments to strengthen those nation-to-nation relationships and push forward in a way that we're seated at the table and that she will champion the issues that we bring to her. So she's opening her door to work with us, but she's been there working for our vote and bringing us to the table, championing our issues already. So I really feel that she's going to be a great voice for us in the United States Senate.
Seminole says with this year's turnout, future elections should become easier to get Native voters to the polls and get candidates that will represent and be accountable to the needs of Native people in North Dakota. During this week in 1990, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act was signed into law. NAGPRA provides a process for museums and federal agencies to return certain Native American sacred items, human remains, and cultural and funerary objects to tribes. This is National Native News. I'm Tristan Ottone.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, providing services for identification, evaluation, and rehabilitation for individuals with hearing difficulties. Located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780.
Todd Hunt requires us to play that sort of entry music every time he comes into the studio.
It's my theme song.
It's sort of this thing. He goes, no, wait for it. Wait, now. Todd Hunt, the conductor of the Amalga Chamber Orchestra and the artistic director of Opera to Go, is here. How you doing?
Yeah, pretty well.
Well,
how about yourself?
I'm doing great. You guys are doing a couple of performances coming up November 17th and 18th, this Saturday and Sunday. Tell me about what you guys are doing.
Yeah, well, we've got actually a pretty cool program in store. We've got Mozart, which we're listening to right now, a Mozart symphony, something we don't hear very often in Juneau. We've got a Schubert symphony, something
we don't hear. Symphony,
the unfinished symphony, yeah,
so
probably his most famous.
So
the unfinished symphony. It's funny. It's people kind of assume that he must have died while
writing it.
All those composers would.
It's a good
die.
Story,
yeah, but that's not what happened. He just didn't finish it, and we're not sure why. Actually.
So it was sort of mid-career even?
No, he still had probably 5 or 6 more years to live, mm-hmm. which unfortunately for him was about mid-career. Mm-hmm. He put out some sketches for third movement. We've got 2 movements, and we're going to play 2 of them, and there's sketches for third, and he just sort of abandoned it right away, and that's all we've got.
Has anyone ever gone in and tried to finish the unfinished?
Totally.
People have done that?
Yeah. Through the years, there have been lots of competitions and whatnot, for people to finish it or to do things, write other pieces that are,
thematic to what he
to
did.
That.
Yeah, right,
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Interesting.
So, it's one of his most famous, works.
Yeah, 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 right.
It's one of those things that everybody knows. And we're also doing an aria from Rory Stitt's new opera that is currently, getting orchestrated at this point. So we've got, the piano score, and this is the first part of it that's, done.
Right. He did that really interesting, interactive performance of it. Mm-hmm. Earlier,
right.
About a month ago.
Yeah. A little less than a month ago, actually.
And that's very cool, actually listening, wanting feedback and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and so we got actually loads of feedback from that. We've just gotten done compiling it. And
now, you say we. Are you working with him on it?
Totally. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
As artistic director of Opera to Go, Opera to Go commissioned it. So we've been working really closely, on getting this up and running.
Mm-hmm.
And, mostly... tweaking stories, the music and the casting as well, you know, looking for ways that we can, you know, do it really effectively here.
So this is a new opera that's being
totally
written.
Totally new.
I mean, this isn't what you guys are doing now, but this is a fascinating thing to talk about, another project that you guys are working on.
And it's been a long time in coming, too. Probably 3 years in the works. Yeah, and Rory has written the libretto as well, the story, all the words that are in the opera, and, of course, the music as well. And, got it done just in time for that workshop a few weeks ago.
Yeah. Are there many new operas?
There are a few out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, at least a few times a year, I'll see a big premiere of something. These days, it's usually things based on famous literature. You know, it's
okay.
Scarlet Letter, Wuthering Heights, that sort of thing that you get. Some name recognition.
We're waiting for Lincoln the opera.
Lincoln the opera. It's
got potential.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah, it's tragic. It's a tragedy.
Yeah,
that's for sure. But now tell me about what goes into choosing the works you wanted to know. Is there even though these are three different, very different works, is there some sort of a thematic thing that you as a musician feel like runs through it?
Actually, there's one more.
Oh, okay.
There's the Charles Griffiths is an early American, but like early 20th century composer, and he wrote this piece called Poem for Flute and Orchestra, and we're doing this with Sally Schlichting, who's one of our local gems that we've had here. So that's yet another sort of level of this putting together a program where when I do this, I'm looking for a way to make something with lots of variety yet holds together in a certain way and fits in a certain time frame with a certain number of instrumentalists.
I see.
So we've got about 30.
So some of it's just logistics.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Okay, this one requires this many cellists or this many.
Right.
And also, there's these other pieces that also require that.
Right.
And so they may be wildly different, but the logistics are there. Yeah.
Now, each of the pieces we're doing has a slightly different number of people, but it's roughly the same.
Yeah.
In the same ballpark. Anyway.
And then you were saying that we're going to hear a Mozart symphony, full symphony.
Yeah.
So that is that. How long does that go?
So this one, what we're hearing in the background here is the symphony number 38 out of 41 that he wrote. And this one's kind of strange because it only has three movements to the symphony. Most of the classical symphonies at the time have four movements.
Okay.
He's left out what we think of as the third.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. It's compact in that sort of way, but the first movement is so big that it kind of makes up for it. It's like, oh, good thing it doesn't have a third movement, because then it'd be just too long.
Right.
It's about 25 minutes or so.
Uh-huh.
The Schubert's about the same, 25 minutes and two movements.
Mm-hmm.
The Stitt aria is probably five or six, and Griffiths is nine. Yeah.
I'm a layman.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to classical music, it's beautiful, but I'm a layman. So you have the movements. Now, tell me what typically a first, second, third, and fourth movement is supposed to achieve in a work.
Right. So the first movement tends to have the most weight of a symphony. If we're talking about a four-movement thing here, it tends to be the most serious, has the most complexity. The second movement is often the slow one, the lyrical, where you just get to step back and say, oh, that's really nice. The third movement is often a dance of some sort, so a little more upbeat, again, a little bit light, too. And the fourth movement tends to be a rip-roaring fast thing.
Does that have a historical significance, the way the symphonies were used when they were first performed?
Absolutely. They were, I mean, when they, well, actually not totally true.
Okay.
When they were often first performed, sometimes they weren't put all together. They just do one movement here, and it's like, do another movement of something else. And,
oh, okay.
Yeah, so there'd be some mix and match. And as time went on, as we got into like the middle of the 19th century or so, things started to settle down, and we get more of what we know of today. But yeah, all of this, symphonic stuff grew out of operas, really. Opera overtures having this sort of, fast, slow, fast kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of ballooned into this ginormous thing. You know, we get these like late 19th century, early 20th century symphonies of like Mahler that go on for an hour and a half.
Right, like, right.
That's the sort of the apex of where all this is headed.
He was really stuck on himself there. Just kept going and going.
Going
people
and going.
Want to hear this.
Oh, they do. They do.
Yeah,
they've got it.
Well, okay, it's happening Saturday and Sunday. Tell me those kind of details on the performances and how people can get tickets and all that.
Yeah, so let's see, Saturday and Sunday, this coming Saturday and Sunday, 8 o'clock on Saturday and 3 o'clock on Sunday at Northern Light Church. That's in the flats downtown over there on 11th Street. Tickets are 15 general, 13 seniors, and $5 student tickets.
All right, that's great. Saying,
yeah, it's one of these things, you know, you see kids or young adults even, you know, who want to go to concerts or performances or whatever, and like, well, I don't know, I can't afford it. And, you know, something like this should be completely accessible for them and should be cheaper than a movie.
Yeah, those are the people you want to reach.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
keep it going.
Totally.
Keep it going.
Yeah, and you can get tickets online, operatogo.net, or at the Jack, at the Hearthside locations, Rainy Retreat, all the normal.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, it's the Amalga Chamber Orchestra. It's happening this weekend, Saturday at 8, Sunday at 3, Northern Lights Church. Mm-hmm. Todd Hunt is the conductor, and he's with us today. Thanks, Todd, for coming in.
Well, thank you
so much. Great talking to you.
Yeah, you too.
Music from Mozart there. Amalga Chamber Orchestra will be performing that this weekend. Also happening this weekend, there's a Survivors of Suicide Day event, and I've got representatives from various organizations here with me right now that are helping put that together. Megan Gregory, Lindsay Cotto, and Dove Gartenberger with me. Thanks, everyone, for coming in.
Appreciate it to be here.
Yeah. Megan, maybe I'll just start with you. Tell me just a little bit about what people should know about this day, this, you know, the kind of the whole idea of the day.
Okay, well, the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium and National Alliance on Mental Illness will join hundreds of other sites around the world to host the 14th annual International Survivors of Suicide Day. And what that is it's a day designed to support those people who have lost loved ones to suicide, giving survivors a chance to share their experiences and be supported in their loss. It's also a chance to get information about resources and healing.
Okay. And Lindsay, what organization are you with and how are you involved with it?
I'm kind of representing two hats right now. One would be with the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. I'm their intern for the rest of this month. And then I'm slowly transitioning to my new position as the community-based service coordinator for NAMI as their suicide prevention coordinator.
Yeah, great. So a day like this, What are the things that are trying to be achieved by bringing awareness to this issue in this one day?
I think definitely a connectedness with the community, because we have been bereaved by suicide here, to bring together a bunch of people that have been affected, and supporting them and showing them the resources and that they're not alone.
And Dov, you're a rabbi here in town, a spiritual leader here in town, and is that the capacity with which you're doing this?
No.
Oh, okay. So tell me the capacity with which you're doing
that. That's my other hat. I'm actually the new director of NAMI Juno.
Oh, okay. Great. All right.
So it started 3 weeks ago, and very happy to be involved in the community and be part of this program. And Megan and Lindsay are really playing a major role in planning it. And this is part of our umbrella, providing support for those with mental illness, mm-hmm. and we're engaged in suicide prevention and support for those who have lost loved ones because of suicide.
It seems like such a key issue in Alaska, especially. It seems like we're a state that's really hard hit with this issue.
We're twice, our rates are twice as high as the national average.
Yeah.
So we are definitely hit harder here.
Yeah, and from the agency that you work for, Search, tell me about some of the concerns you have there and some of the ways that you feel like it's important to reach Alaskans especially.
Well, we feel like it's very important to get our youth involved so that they can share information with their peers. And one way we're doing that is we're implementing the Youth Ambassador Program this fall, which is something else I'd like to advocate for really quickly. And we're looking for one representative from every community in Southeast to work with our One Is Too Many Task Force. And we currently have three. We have one who I just selected yesterday, and his name is Justin Watanabe, who will be representing Thunder Mountain High School, Patricia Jackson from Petersburg, and Teodola Silva from Angoon. And we're actually looking for six youth ambassadors from Juno, two from every high school. So if you're interested, visit Search, SEARHC.org, and look under the Youth tab for the Youth Ambassador Program and apply today. We would love to have you.
The Youth Ambassador Program is specific to the issue of suicide prevention?
It is, but it's also encouraging youth to be leaders in their community, positive leaders in their community, but at the same time working with us to advocate for suicide prevention.
Yeah, such a great cause, and that is a great way to be a leader in the community to approach that issue. So what are some of the events that are happening Saturday? Tell me about just a couple of the events that are happening.
Well, let's see. So we are showing the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention DVD. They do a Survivors of Suicide showing, and it's actually, you can live stream it. It's on the East Coast, and so I believe it's early in the morning from 9 to 10:30 if you wanted to see that online. But we're showing it later in the afternoon for us people in Alaska. And then we'll also, Silver Bow's going to be doing our catering. So
nice.
We'll have food there.
All right.
And then, so after the DVD, we're going to have Sandra Sexton Jones, and she's going to introduce herself and her survivor story. She's part of the coalition, and she's also a licensed counselor, grief counselor. And she's also running a survivors group, too, for the next 8 weeks. And kind of invite people to share their stories. And then we're going to walk over to Marine Park and light some luminaries. And I believe we're going to be lighting 150 luminary lanterns for the 150 suicides that happened in 2010 for Alaska.
Wow, it's a hard number to hear, isn't it? 150 people. So tell me about NAMI's role in this, and just what are some of the kind of overall initiatives that NAMI has to kind of approach this issue?
Well, NAMI has a number of different initiatives. We focus on support, education, and advocacy. So this would be probably a support/education type of activity. Mm-hmm. But we also have support groups for families that have loved ones with mental illness, for those who suffer from mental illness. We have a program of education for families called Family to Family that is a 12-week course that offers all sorts of information on types of diagnoses, working with the behavioral health system, advocacy, and so forth. And this is a really great opportunity for people who are really suffering, going through a very confusing period having discovered a mental illness or having a loved one who is suffering from mental illness. So that's the bulk of the work that we do, and this is mm-hmm. a very important part of it.
Lindsay, you've worked with suicide prevention on sort of a prevention line, kind of sort of on the front lines a little bit, talking to people and that sort of thing?
Let's see. In September, I took an internship position with the Statewide Suicide Prevention Council. Mm-hmm. The last 5 years, I studied at Oregon State for health promotion and mm-hmm. prevention programs specifically related to suicide prevention in Alaska. So I wouldn't say I've been on the front lines as a counselor or anything like that, but definitely studying the brains behind prevention programs and what works best and best practices.
Well, what are some of the misconceptions that people might have about people, about suicide in general as an issue, and also about ways of preventing suicide?
I've heard from different people. One thing that we're really trying to emphasize is suicide is preventable. It really is. It's programs have been shown to work. Also, there's a big stigma with the word suicide. So when you have people saying suicide, people kind of tend to cringe away from it. So what we're really trying to do is destigmatize the word suicide and suicide prevention and really encourage people to step forward and take charge and really help this. Mm-hmm. This cause.
And this, just that idea of getting people involved, getting people to talk to folks and all that just seems like such a great move forward.
Community connectedness.
Yeah.
For sure. Just getting involved and knowing that you're helping someone is a great way to help yourself as well.
Well, a great first step is to be involved with the Suicide Survivors of Suicide Day and these events that are happening. Maybe just a recap, Megan, of where people can go and what they can do and expect to be involved in this day.
All right. Well, it's going to be on Saturday, November 17th. We're going to have registration from 2:30 to 3 p.m. From 3 p.m. to 4 p.m., we're going to have the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention DVD. From 4 p.m. to 4:45 p.m., survivors will have some time to offer stories and offer stories of hope and healing. And from 5 p.m. to 5:30, we'll walk to Marine Park for the luminary lighting ceremony. And it will all be at Centennial Hall in the Hammond Room. And if people don't feel like coming to watch the DVD, we still encourage them to walk with us to Marine Park and help us light the luminary.
Just be a voice, mm-hmm. someone there to show your support for folks
please.
Who've been struggling with this. Yeah,
please come show your support.
Well, thanks to all you for coming in.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It,
thank
and have
you
a great day
us.
On Saturday at the event.
Thank you. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 15th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of Georgia O'Keeffe, the painter, born Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, 1887. She lived in New York for a time. It was there she started to paint the enormous flowers for which she is best known. But she took a trip out to Taos, New Mexico, and she came to love the desert. She felt that the thin, dry air enabled her to see farther, and she devoted much of the rest of her career to painting desert scenery. Georgia O'Keeffe, who said, "I've been absolutely terrified every moment of my life, and I've never let it keep me from doing a single thing I wanted to do." It's the birthday of Marianne Moore, born Kirkwood, Missouri, 1887. Her father was an engineer and inventor, spent his life trying to build a smokeless furnace. When his business failed, he had a nervous breakdown. He had to go to an institution for the mentally ill. Marianne Moore was born just after her parents had separated, and she never met her father. She went to Bryn Mawr College, where she majored in biology, and where working in a laboratory had a profound effect on her writing. Marianne Moore, who said, "Precision, economy of statement, logic, drawing and identifying liberated my imagination." It was on this day, 1940, 75,000 men were called to armed forces duty under the first peacetime conscription in American history. The draft, never popular in America. In 1939, a poll had shown only 35% of Americans approved of a draft. But by 1940, with Hitler's army invading, occupying Poland and France, support for a draft had gone up to 92%. So in October of 1940, 16 million young men registered with the Selective Service, the first 75,000 draftees called up to service on this day, 1940. And it's the birthday of the poet Ted Barragan, born Providence, Rhode Island, 1934. Served in the Korean War, went to college, University of Tulsa, then went to live on the Lower East Side of New York City. In the early 60s, began writing his collection of 14-line poems called The Sonnets, which came out in 1964. It was a big success. Wrote the first 6 sonnets in one night, then wrote 2 or 3 per day for about 3 months. Here's a poem by Ted Barragan on his birthday, entitled Autumn's Day, after Rilke. Lord, it is time. Summer was very great. Now cast your shadow upon sundials. Let winds remind meadows it is late. Mellow now the last fruits on the vine. Allow them only 2 more southern days. Hasten them to fullness and press the last heavy sweetness through the wine. Who has no home cannot build now. Who dwells alone must now remain alone. Will waken, read, write long letters, and will wander restlessly when leaves are blowing. Autumn's Day, a poem by Ted Barragan from the collected poems published by University of California Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Wall Street Journal, with features written to help discover something new every day, including weekends. Subscriptions to the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition at wsj.com/getweekend. And by the Poetry Foundation, you can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's Poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
At the Juno Arts and Culture Center, Saturday, November 17th, for the Lord of the Rings movie marathon.
Prizes, costume contest, trivia challenge, and all 3 extended version films on the big screen.
Proceeds benefit the Alaska Youth Choir. Tickets available online at the Jack, Hearthside, and at the door.
Go to jahc.org to learn more. The Lord of the Rings movie marathon, Saturday, November 17th.
For Frodo!
We're back in a Juno afternoon here, and rain is the forecast for this evening. Then a chance of snow late. Chance of snow in the morning tomorrow with a possible accumulation up to 1 inch. Snow level increasing to 1,300 feet, though, in the afternoon with rain taking over. Highs around 37 degrees. That's sort of the forecast for Friday night, Saturday, too, with some rain, some snow. And then clearing up a little bit heading into Saturday night and Sunday with just mostly cloudy skies, but a little cooler temperatures. Low Saturday night, 19 degrees, and highs 30 on Sunday. Joined next by a bunch of folks who are here to talk about a fundraiser for the National Adoption Month fundraiser, and it's called the Brittany's Hope Foundation. And with me now are Debbie Chalmers Lee Ming and Jeannie Kanin. Thanks to you all for coming and joining me here in a June afternoon. Appreciate it. I'll start with you, Jeannie. Tell me a little bit about the program itself, the National Adoption Month, first of all, and then this specific foundation called Brittany's Hope Foundation, which sounds like a really interesting, cool
thing.
Thanks
for having us.
Sure.
Brittany's Hope, well, first off, National Adoption Month, I believe it was established about a decade ago. And this is our first kind of foray into celebrating here in Juneau. There was a woman that passed away several years ago by the name of Sue Glocky, and we wanted to kind of honor her. She had traveled all over Europe, and she found herself in Romania supporting orphans there, and she did this in her retirement years. So we decided we wanted to honor her during National Adoption Month and have the first annual Sue Glocky Adoption Fundraiser. Last year, my husband and I brought home our daughter, Li Ming.
She's here with us.
Hi, Li Ming.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Welcome.
And so she was a recipient of a Brittany's Hope grant. It's a seedling grant where Brittany's Hope provides a matching funds up to $5,000. So we were able to fundraise $2,500, and they matched it for a grand total of $5,000, which helped us bring her home to America.
Wow, that's such a great little additional boost to have this thing happen. Yeah.
It is huge. You know, and they also support domestic adoptions as well as international adoptions.
And Li Ming, where are you from?
I'm from China, Canton.
Canton, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, so you made the journey here. Mm-hmm. Life's a little different now, I guess, huh?
Yes.
Well, it's exciting to have you here. How do you like Juneau?
Very good. Just cold and snow. But I really like snowing, though.
Yeah. Now, you speak English really well. Did you have English already? Had you already spoke English when you lived in China?
No, I don't. I just come here. I just start English.
That's amazing. You speak so well.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, Debbie, you were a friend of remind me the name.
Sue Glocky.
Sue Glocky, and tell me about her connection to adoption.
She started traveling in the 80s in Africa, and then Bosnia and Romania, and worked in orphanages, a leper colony. She was amazing after retiring from the state here. And really embraced the orphanages in Romania. She was a physical therapist and worked really hard during a time where the children were institutionalized and were literally bound in weren't removed from their cribs at any time. So they could be 5 years old and have never walked. Mm. And so she really helped teach them how to walk and start the process all over for them. My nephew is adopted as a result of Sue's interventions. My twin sister, Kathy Brown, who's a teacher here and teaches with me, she was trying to discern if adoption was the right path for her, and met Sue through our church community. And Sue said, I have just the right child for you.
Have I got a kid for you? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
It just was love at first sight. And that's a whole other story how that match came to be. But Sue started Juneau Cares in the 90s, I believe. And what she did was she would hold meetings at the downtown library and get local support and take local funds with her and just cut out the middleman and make sure that projects that directly impacted the children, food, bathrooms, building a bathroom, that kind of thing, getting tricycles, all sorts of things went directly to the children, and she made sure it happened.
Yeah, so, the whole process of adoption, I think, can seem so daunting. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure there's very many people who say, well, I would do that. That sounds great. But then, you know, just trying to find out where to go first, what first steps to take, and then figuring out the whole process. So just tell me a little bit about that process and how this whole effort makes that easier for people.
Okay. You know, our process was international. We've adopted actually twice, and both of them were to China. So there are a whole different set of criteria and hurdles that you have to get through for domestic adoption. But for us, you know, you start by going through United States immigration, and you start with this big dossier and paperwork. And, I mean, the front end of the expenses are all related to the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. And so there's a big chunk of change that that has to happen for immigration and for the dossier. And then once that paperwork goes over to China, there is a small amount that you take to the orphanage, that you give to the orphanage because they've been raising your child for, in her case, almost 14 years.
Right.
So we've done, you know, there are different ways to do fundraisers. Sometimes you can get grants, but generally you're on your own unless it's a special needs child. Or if you adopt domestically, you might adopt through the foster care system here, mm-hmm. which is another great way to go.
Yeah.
So we're just advocating for adoption in general, sure. whether it's international or domestic.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, okay, so it's happening Sunday. Now, this we haven't mentioned yet. This is a yeah. Texas-style barbecue that's happening. Yeah. I mean, this, I'm excited about this.
Barbecue brisket.
Absolutely.
Music so, and yeah. dancing. Yep.
All happening Sunday at 6?
Sunday at 6 o'clock at St. Anne's Parish Hall.
And just a big dinner and music, and you're asking people if they might maybe play an instrument to bring an instrument and
yep,
join
it's
in?
Just a big jam, and, you know, where it's very flexible and just open to people that, you know, if there's little kids that want to play their recorder, they can do that as well as, you know, an accomplished musician as well.
Yes, yeah. absolutely. All right. Well, it's all happening Sunday. It starts at 6 o'clock. It's all going towards the National Adoption Month, and the Brittany's Hope Foundation is
That's
where
correct.
The funds will actually
That's
end
correct.
Up.
That's correct. And there is a family in town that will be a recipient of a grant if we're able to get the funds together through Brittany's Hope. So, and they're hoping to be traveling next year to China again.
Great. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all happening Sunday. Thanks to you all for coming in.
Thank you for hosting.
And thanks, Li Ming, especially for coming in. Is this your first time on the radio?
Yes.
All right. Well, you did great.
Thank you.
Way to go.
Oh, and,
all right.
I just wanted to mention.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to mention quickly that Sue also adopted a young person, Nico, who is now 21 years old.
Oh, fantastic!
So here in Juneau.
All right.
So.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks to you all for coming
Thank
in,
you.
And have a great time on Sunday.
Thanks.
The barbecue.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Welcome back to A Juneau Afternoon. In the studio with me now is writer, park ranger, photographer, Karsten Hoyer. Karsten, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And also here is Sarah Ray from UAS, and you're a professor of English at UAS.
Yeah, thanks for having
You've
us.
You've got Karsten in town, and Karsten and his wife, Leanne Allison, are in town. And tell us a little bit, Karsten, about what you do. Introduce people to yourself. You have a great variety of titles, one of which I love. You're
Adventurer.
Yeah. I love that.
Well, the reason we're in town is UAS chose to use a book that I wrote, Being Caribou, as their one campus, one book, where all the incoming freshman students are obligated to read a book. And it kind of ties together the campus and, you know, it provides some level of cohesion. And then part of the program is the author comes to visit and a bunch of the classes, which I've been doing over the last 2 days, and then also gives a public lecture, which I'll do on Friday night. But the neat thing, too, is my wife and I both got to come because my wife has made a film that kind of parallels the same subject matter of the book. And that subject matter was in 2003, the two of us went out to try to capture the caribou's voice in this ongoing debate about whether or not to develop the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil.
That's an interesting concept, capturing the caribou's voice. Is that how you entered the project? That was the concept you had?
Yeah, you know, this debate over whether or not to drill or whether to protect the calving grounds and the whole coastal plain.
We've heard from everyone except for...
exactly. You know, we've heard it argued in millions of barrels of oil to be gained and the, you know, thousands of jobs to be created, but we never really captured it from the caribou's perspective. And so Leanne and I started to think, well, what would that be if they had a voice? And what we decided, the value of that place to them is captured in everything they go through to get to those calving grounds and back again on their annual migration, which spans over 1,500 miles.
Yeah, it's an amazing, it's one of the great migrations left on Earth of wild animals. It's an incredible spectacle, I'm sure.
Yeah, so, you know, the rivers they had to ford, the bears that they had to, who are lying in wait in the willows that they had to avoid, the wolf pack they had to, you know, try and circumvent, the hordes of bugs in the bug season, the blizzards, the depth of the snowdrifts. And we would capture that, we thought, best if we actually experienced ourselves.
So. I was going to say, so yeah, the caribou have to do it, but they're kind of built for that. So that's quite a task to take on.
Yeah, and we really didn't know if it was possible, quite frankly. And a lot of people at the beginning sort of said, you know, you guys are nuts or this is impossible. But there are enough people that said, wow, like it actually might be possible, and wouldn't that be an incredible experience?
And just a two-person team, just
yeah.
you and your wife.
And, you know, we were at this point in human history where things like satellite phones were light enough, the film equipment was light enough, we could carry this sort of backpackable solar panel on our back to recharge the batteries for these various sort of appliances to allow us to actually capture this story. And that's the story that's going to be screening tonight at the U.S.
Yeah, let's quickly mention the things that people can go to see this stuff. Sarah, we've got the film showing tonight, and when is that?
Yeah, the film showing is in conjunction with a class I'm teaching in the English department called Environmental Film. So it's the second to last of a series of films for that, which is great. So we're holding those in Egan 112 at 5:30 tonight.
And then there's a question and answer with your wife, Leanne Allison, after that,
right.
which is exciting to be able to talk to the filmmaker after watching a film. It's always such a great learning experience.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We've already been enjoying her. They came to our class yesterday, and it was great.
Very cool. And then Evening at Egan lecture happening on Friday that you'll be conducting.
Yeah, and then that, you know, the Being Caribou story will be a part of it, but we're going to touch upon a suite of expeditions we've done, of which Being Caribou is one. So we walked from Yellowstone to the Yukon back in the late 90s. We followed the caribou herd, and then we actually canoed and sailed across Canada with our 2-year-old son for another project in 2007. And I really want to tie all those together underneath this umbrella by which we use to describe our journeys, which is called Necessary Journeys.
So tell me, what lit the fire for you? What makes you go do this?
What makes us tick?
Yeah.
I think, you know, for Leanne and I, it's partly how we're wired, these kind of broad-scale adventures. But I'm also trained as a scientist, and as a scientist, I have always seen this gap that exists between what we learn in science and what the general population kind of knows. And so we're trying to bridge that gap, if you will, by telling compelling stories through these adventures about these specific organisms whose needs are actually quite a bit different than I think we fully appreciate as humans.
Yeah, it's a fascinating – I mean, it's the kind of life people dream about leading often, but – you know, hardly anyone does it. It seems like in this day and age, it's funny because, as you say, there's these abilities, there's this technology that's gotten us to the point where we can do things like this. But I think that people feel like adventures are gone or something, or maybe the world has been tamed. You know, I think that that's a concept that people have.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair take on it to some extent. But also, you know, the parallel process that's going on is we were discovering more and more about the wonders and sort of awe-inspiring aspects of the natural world and the intricacies and all the interrelatedness of it. And that, you know, for each layer that we uncover through science, it's kind of like we realize just how little we know. And that was the story we also wanted to get into with this trip. And some amazingly spiritual things happened to us during the course of 5 months, as you can imagine. You know, this is an area with no pipelines, no roads, no human structures whatsoever that we were completely immersed in for 5 months. And, you know, although we were a little bit facetious with the title of Being Caribou, we actually did come very close to becoming caribou during the course of the journey, to communicating with them at a level that, you know, we had never communicated with anything outside of our own species before, of sort of unlocking this way of seeing into the future by having our senses completely opened during the course of this journey, where we weren't distracted by, you know, the cell phones and the email alarms and the sirens, the billboards, all these things that we kind of have to shut out in modern life.
Radios.
Yeah, we were able to turn all that stuff off, not just physically, but in our minds, and allow ourselves to become wild again, to become animals in amongst this herd of 120,000 animals. And I think, you know, I think that's the thing that most resonates with people the most when they see our film and read the book.
Tell me about your daily life. What kind of gear? I mean, did you just have a simple tent? I mean, what sort of, you know, how did it all work?
Yeah, we kind of took an alpinist approach to the trip, if you will. So, you know, it was not unlike somebody trying to plan a trip to go up Everest, where you're seeking out the sort of lightest materials, but the most robust materials as well for your tent. So, you know, we had a single wall Gore-Tex tent. We had the latest in sort of wicking clothing so that we wouldn't, you know, moisture against our skin wouldn't freeze.
Were you guys sponsored?
Breathable jackets.
Do you have like sponsors and stuff like that that you were able to?
We had some. You know, it wasn't sort of huge North Face sponsorships or anything. It was all pretty grassroots, but we did have some support that really helped.
Right.
And so Mountain Equipment Co-op, which is kind of the Canadian version of REI, was one of our major sponsors for this trip.
Tell me about some of your other journeys as well that you'll be kind of speaking about during Evening at Egan.
Yeah, the first one was called the Y to Y Hike, Yellowstone to Yukon. And it's this conservation initiative that recognizes that individual wide-ranging animals actually need much more than we have set aside for them in individual parks and reserves.
It's truly interesting to think about that. The range that some of these big animals especially need is beyond our comprehension sometimes.
Yeah, like there was one story particular of a wolf that was radio collared very close to where I live near Banff, Alberta. And she moved from Alberta down into northern Montana, over into northern Idaho, up into west central British Columbia, and then sort of finally came back into the Rockies. And those movements encompassed an area of 20 times the size of Banff National Park, 10 times the size of Yellowstone. And it really was an articulation from this animal of how much more space and range they need. And so this Y to Y or Yellowstone to Yukon initiative is really about connecting individual parks and reserves with designated corridors. And so we decided to try to be one of those animals, one of those wolves or grizzly bears or wolverines that these corridors are meant to try to accommodate and to travel them for ourselves and see what kind of barriers do or don't exist in that region. So when those barriers might be physical or they might be social, you know, as we stopped in the communities and sort of came head-to-head with some of the values that people have who are living and working in those landscapes.
So and then you also did a largely water-based trip as well, right?
Yeah, there's this author. He's now 91 years old. His name is Farley Mowat. Alaskans might know him through some of his more famous works like Never Cry Wolf. He's written over 40 books, and that became a Disney movie.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
Anyway, he was a great hero of mine. And when I wrote the book Being Caribou from our last trip, I sent it off to him, you know, kind of totally cold, didn't know him, sent it by way of his publisher. He wrote this great note back that he loved it. And we had tons to talk about, why don't we come visit? He lives on the opposite side of Canada as us. We live in the Rocky Mountains. He lives on the East Coast. And so rather than fly or drive, Leanne and I thought, let's pay tribute to this hero of ours, to his life. And so we decided to go in a way that's much in keeping with how his characters lived and traveled in all his books. And so that's why we canoed and sailed, and we actually chose a route that took us through as many of the settings of his books along the way and revisited many of the issues that he'd raised decades before and sort of compared them by way of letter exchange with him and then finally arrived at his house and met him in person at the end.
Sounds like a great journey. Tell me about reentry into society after talking to caribou for 5 months.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah, I was talking to a class up at the university this morning and I likened it probably, although I don't know this personally myself, probably to what a lot of war veterans feel when they come back and they kind of find that the things that people are kind of caught up with and are important to them actually registers having very little meaning in relationship to what the sort of intensity of the experience that they've had abroad. And although we looked the same when we came back, that was the big struggle because, you know, our parents and our friends, I think, continued to treat us the same, and yet, you know, it was as though our internal compasses had completely reoriented themselves by virtue of all the powerful things that had happened amongst these caribou during the course of our journey. And quite frankly, Andy, you know, it's 10 years later, we're still struggling with that reentry to some extent and to come to terms with it and to find aspects of that incredible life we had amongst the caribou in our everyday lives integrated in modern civilization back at home.
Would you say there's one, especially from that journey with the caribou, is there one thing that you, and this is probably many things, but is there one thing that you learned in particular?
Yeah, again, this morning I talked a lot with the students. You know, I think I left as a scientist, and I kind of wanted to sort of capture this almost technical story about the caribou and everything they go through. And I came back sort of as a much more developed person with a very kind of almost spiritual aspect or component and sense of place, mm-hmm. And also a sense of history and how we fit into the long sort of almost geological story of landscapes. And that it was as though the caribou story started speaking through us rather than us telling it. We became conduits or vessels for the story that's been out there for at least 27,000 years, according to the archaeological evidence.
Right, give or take.
Give or take.
Yeah. Yeah. Sarah, tell me a little bit more about the One Campus, One Book program and how this fits in.
Yeah, well, the One Campus, One Book program was started about 4 years ago, and it came out of a student success task force based on student feedback that there wasn't as much community on campus as they would have liked, and there's sort of a sense of disconnection and alienation, and this is one of the things that got taken up, and we've had a couple of books. It's gaining momentum. I'd say this is a really great year. We're having an unprecedented amount of faculty use this book. 11 faculty are teaching it. Carson and Leanne's visit is one aspect of the programming. But we also had Randall Tetlici with Gwich'in Elder in Residence last week here for a week, mm-hmm. which was really incredible. And he gave last week's Elder in Residence. So we're culminating 2 weeks here of really great programming for the One Campus, One Book.
Such a cool idea. I mean, really. And just unifying a campus is such a great, such a great thing to...
I wish I had it in my university.
Yeah, I know. Mine would have been, a little bit, 40,000 undergraduates. So all reading the same book. That would have been a great move for that author. Yeah. but maybe they're doing it now. I don't know. Well, it's all happening tonight is the film itself that was done by Leanne Allison, who we've been talking about, your wife, who's a filmmaker. And that's called Being Caribou. It's the companion film to the book. And the book is Being Caribou, one of a number of books that you've been able to write about your adventures, and you'll be talking about that during Evening at Egan, which is happening Friday at 7 at the Egan Library. So Karsten Hoyer and Sarah Wright, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much. Man.
Okay. Thanks.
And welcome back to June Afternoon. Nancy DeCherney has joined us. Nancy.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm good. Dark outside.
It is dark. It is dark outside.
But we're going to shed light on the whole thing. Let's go.
The arts are a beacon of light in our otherwise dark existence.
All right, then.
Yes.
Okay, so at 5 o'clock, head out to the University of Alaska Southeast Sobeloff Building for the Art Open House.
Okay.
I think that should be fun.
Wow, all right. That's tonight?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
And at 5:30 tonight, there's Being Caribou, the UAS environmental film series. So you can do both out there. Those are free.
That's who we just talked to, who was just in the studio with us.
Okay. Songs and Stories in Spanish. It is the third Thursday family night at Valley Library.
Okay.
It's also free. It's at 5:30. 6 p.m., Foxes, Mink, Skunks, and Coons.
Absolutely. I'm in.
There are no skunks.
What are we talking about now? What in the world?
The Fur Farms of Southeast Alaska. This is a presentation by Sarah Isto and others that the Gastineau Channel Historical Society is offering. Huh. And this is at the Community Room 2 in Nugget Mall.
This is a fascinating part of our history when
very interesting.
Fox farms and things were all over the place. Yeah.
Legend of Sleepy Hollow is being performed at 7:30 at the Perseverance Theater, second stage. This is a young company performance. I haven't heard reviews on it yet, but I'm sure it should be fun. It's a great story.
Sure.
So tickets are at the door. And, of course, this week we have Oklahoma. We have Macbeth. This is the last weekend for Macbeth. So I rest my case.
Yes, it's been absolute rave reviews from everyone who's seen it. Yep.
Yes, and then we've already spoken about the Absinthe films, so we don't need to talk about that.
Yeah, Residence. We talked to one of the writers yesterday. That's happening tonight at Centennial.
Okay, so we'll zoom into Friday. And I want to just say, at 11 o'clock tomorrow, please do your shopping at Foodland and spring me from jail.
Are you? You are someone who needs to be sprung from jail.
I will be in jail, and I would appreciate your assistance.
Okay. So that's a canned food drive.
Yes,
is that right?
Yes, yeah. For the food bank. So come on down to Foodland at 11. We always have the Kimball Organ Concert. Sometimes I don't mention it, but I just want to remind everybody that's a fun thing to do at noon at the State Office Building. At 1:30, there is a virtual tour of the Mariners Museum. This is homeschool day at the Valley Public Library. It is at 6 p.m. Mouche Canadier Poetry Slam and Open Mic. Season 3 begins.
Yes.
Have you talked about this?
I haven't yet, okay. No, but it's going to be great, yeah.
The theme is secrets. They're going to be at the Juno Douglas High School Auditorium. It is pay-as-you-can, and proceeds are helping to benefit DJ Manu, who's was part of the Gastineau fire problems.
Yeah, Choco. He owns Choco there, and has lost a lot of inventory and stuff.
Yes, you've already talked about the evening at Egan.
Yes.
And Once Upon a Mattress is running this weekend, also only this weekend, so don't miss that. That's at Thunder Mountain High School. Macbeth, Oklahoma.
Yeah, and the Once Upon a Mattress, as you said, it's one weekend only, Thunder Mountain High School.
Fun
going to be
story.
Fun, and this
yes.
is with Theater at Latitude 58.
Exactly.
Very cool organization. Their inaugural performance, so
yes.
That's great.
So go out and support those folks. Oklahoma, and I will have to say, tickets are going pretty fast for this. This weekend, there are not very many tickets, and so if you plan to go, you better get your tickets now for future weekends, because they're
ahead.
Gone. The Wrist Rockets are at the world-famous Red Dog Saloon Friday night.
It is world-famous. There's no denying it. It's world-famous.
And it's going to be even more so because you all are going to be there.
Absolutely.
And it's going to be fun. They'll be dancing.
You're forewarned. There will be dancing.
There will be dancing.
Of a sort.
No,
it'll
be fun.
I'm just kidding. It's great.
All right.
Yeah.
Saturday, the Holiday Bazaar at Northern Light United Church. This starts at 9 a.m. and then at 11. They have homemade soup and bread and pie.
And they have
lunch.
They have six different soups they're going to make.
It's a
smorgasbord of soups. It's a soupsaborg.
Wow. A soup sans soups.
I shouldn't try that on a trained chef, someone like you. Yeah.
Anyway,
yes, it'll
so
be
there
great.
We have it.
Yeah. And they're also selling crafts and all kinds of fun stuff at the bazaar.
I love the holiday season because all this kind of stuff starts to happen.
And I think it's the place, the Antique Roadshow story is going to happen.
Oh,
it can
be.
Happen. I bought this old painting. I turned it around. Yeah. It says Van Gogh on it. Is that real?
Do you
Boom.
Think so? Okay. I'm
going
to go.
Keep going.
Okay.
That's it.
10
You're
going to
go. Okay. Thought you meant you were going to leave the studio. We got another minute and a half.
All right. We have the Reindeer Band is doing their first rehearsal at the Salvation Army. It's at 10 a.m. on Saturday morning, and everybody's welcome to come and play Christmas carols and whatnot.
Awesome.
Their Coffee and Collections this Saturday is the last chance to view the work of Sidney Lawrence exhibit that they have, and there will be discussions about Sidney Lawrence's time in Juno and where he took his inspiration from. So that's at 10:30 and at 1:30. There is a Native artist demonstration over at the Alaska State Museum at 10:30. It's Abel Ryan. He's a Simpson carver and metalsmith. That's free. The Lord of the Rings.
Yes. Happening
it's a
Saturday.
Marathon.
Yes, a marathon of hobbits and hairy feet.
And it starts at 11 and you just see them all.
That's it. Settle in.
Yep. They encourage you to bring your own lounge chairs and all that other sort of stuff.
Only got 25 seconds left.
Okay,
so
we've got that.
No umbrellas happening.
We talked about that.
That night, yes.
All right. And the Legends of Sleepy Hollow. And we have the Nora Down Hour thing on Tuesday at 6 o'clock. She's been selected as the Writer Laureate. We're going to honor her from 5 to 6.
A great place to end.
All
fantastic.
Right,
happening where?
At the Jack.
At the Jack, of course. That's Nancy DeCherney. Here's our news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear.